Hi, it's Anushka here. This week, we are replaying Today in Focus episodes about racism in society. Yesterday, we began with America's response to George Floyd's death. Today, we're remembering how those protests spread across the world and into the UK, where the uprising was, of course, about George Floyd and unjust policing in America, but also very much about issues here in the UK, from Windrush to Grenfell to COVID, and a big debate about our racist past.
The dramatic toppling of the statue of the slave trader Edward Colston at the Black Lives Matter protest in Bristol had really reignited the campaign to remove the statue of the Victorian imperialist Cecil Rhodes at Oxford University. I mean, within hours of Colston's statues being plunged into the Avon, a sign saying "Rhodes, you're next" was taped to the university church just opposite the statue.
And so that is where Guardian reporter Amna Modin headed next. To stand among the crowds gathered under the statue of Cecil Rhodes, an Oxford University benefactor and a white supremacist.
Rhodes' statue is mounted on the wall at Oriel College. It's several stories above the street level, so it's kind of looking down at the people walking by on the high street. Though the protest was called just the day before, over 1,000 people had turned up, which it's incredible. I mean, it was massive. They blocked the road on the high street and the police had to redirect traffic. The atmosphere felt quite electric.
How did the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis lead to this scene in the heart of a historic university town in England, 4,000 miles away? Protests in Britain that have erupted over the past 10 days have not just been about solidarity with the US and not even just about systemic racism here today. They've also been about a long overdue conversation over Britain's past, triggering the biggest reckoning with race that this country has had in decades. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, Britain's racist history and how it is still being felt today. What has made thousands of people, including those at the highest risk when it comes to COVID-19, to take to the streets of Britain to protest? Government ministers have pointed the finger to America and said an uprising here is simply about solidarity. But when The Guardian's Amna Modin joined protesters, day after day,
black is beautiful.
She saw and heard something quite different.
I'd been covering protests for a while, and this was the first one where nearly everyone just had their own homemade placards. It was really homegrown and a quite organic response to what people had been seeing online. The other thing was they were all very, very young.
And how old are you?
18.
How old are you?
22.
And also really multicultural, really diverse, but quite clearly being led by these young, really interesting black activists.
George Floyd! George Floyd! George Floyd!
George Floyd's name was being chanted a lot, and then also the names of Abela Majinga, who's the transport worker who died after this alleged incident where a member of the public spat on her. She died from coronavirus.
Together, we stand in solidarity. Together, we will fight this fight. Together, we will let our voices be heard. Enough is enough.
The protest was very deeply rooted in the British experience. There were frustrations with the way the Windrush generation had been treated. There were loads of, you know, chants for justice for the Windrush generation.
Justice for Windrush!
There was anger that residents from the Grenfell Tower disaster had still not been housed. I was listening to some, again, teenage boys saying it's been 3 years and they've still not been put in accommodation. How disgraceful is that? So it is really rooted in, I think, you know, the issues here in the UK. I think that really distressing video of George Floyd is a spark, but the reason why this flame has endured is because there are so many different reasons. The Black community and the BAME community feel deep anger and frustration. And again, it's that parallel of state violence, feeling real anger at the dramatic increase we're seeing in stop and searches, particularly in London. We know that it's doubled in April compared to the year previously. I live in Newham, and I'm also aware in Lewisham they've been implementing Section 60, and that's been really concerning for the community leaders, because it means, you know, people can be stopped and searched for, you know, no reason whatsoever. And even in the march, I spoke to several young Black boys who were saying, this feels like a particularly sharp moment for us. We're constantly being stop and search. And when we go on Instagram and we go on Twitter, we're seeing white people just out on the beaches and there's nobody telling them to go home. Whereas when we go out, we're immediately being told there's a pandemic, you need to be home. So it's this big feeling of one rule for white people and another rule for us.
Right, so a deep sense of British injustice, not just because of Windrush, not just because of Grenfell, not even just because of the response to COVID, but even policing, as you say, stop and search. But also I saw a mother, Aggie Lewis, give an interview about her son, Olesini, dying after being restrained by 11 officers in 2010, also saying the words, "I can't breathe."
People think it's happening in America. It's not happening here. I just want people to know that it's happening here all the time. The same thing. I can't breathe.
So a sense that while police may not carry weapons here, there are those same injustices for the Black community in Britain.
Definitely. And I think one interview that has really stayed with me was the young Black man, you know, if I can say a man, he's just 18, 19.
When did you realise racism exists in the UK?
When I was probably like 4 years old.
Because he went shopping to a supermarket with his mother, and then as they come out, the security person was convinced he'd put some sort of sweet or something in his pocket.
She stopped my mum, me and my mum, from leaving, and she pulled out the scanner and just started scanning me from head to toe. My mum gave her an earful, but that's when I clocked, like, just looked that differently, like, just targeted.
I mean, this is a four-year-old, and he said, it might not seem like a really big deal, but I was made to feel like a criminal before I learnt to read.
Oh my God. Four.
Yeah, it really took me back. It's not just about the quite physical impacts of racism, but it's also what you internalise.
And Amna, you were there as a reporter, of course, but you're also a woman of colour. I mean, how did you feel personally?
Whenever I see these videos, I have four younger brothers, four young Black siblings, and there's always that kind of gut kind of reaction that's like, oh my God, what if this happened to them? Particularly because one of my siblings is autistic, and I'm always just a bit worried that he might not understand what's going on when he's being stop and search. So I just shot up with this huge amount of fear and just dread. As a news reporter, you need to be an external person looking in, and you don't want to have any sort of influence. But then I go home and I can't leave the issue behind.
Okay, so very much about what's happening in Britain, but not just about what is happening now in a way. It was pretty clear that the anger was also about our history.
I think something that's come up a lot was these kids were really angry that they've had to go out of their way to learn about Britain's role in the slave trade, to learn about what Britain's own civil rights movement looked like. And they don't understand why they're spending years learning about the Tudors. And they don't know that there was this incredible bus boycott campaign in Bristol where drivers were campaigning to be paid equally and fight for their civil rights. And I think that's the problem for the government. If you don't step into this huge gap, they're going to find it elsewhere. And in Bristol, it really wasn't that surprising, I think, for me, that the Edward Colston statue, you know, Edward Colston, this English merchant and slave trader, was finally brought down, because there's been debates on this and arguments for a very long time.
Kayndi Andrews, you're a professor of Black Studies at Birmingham City University. You've been on Today in Focus before to talk about this very issue, who we commemorate from our history and whether we should start removing statues of individuals. And I just obviously want to talk to you about Edward Colston to start. Embarrassingly, I'd never heard of him, but I now see he's been really celebrated in Bristol. There's even a local bun named after him. Sales may not do so well after this. And for more than 100 years, until 2017, they held this weird annual procession in top hats and tails to pay homage to him in the city. But he was a slave trader. Tell me about him.
So Edward Colston is revered in Bristol because, you know, he gave lots and lots of money in terms of philanthropy to the city. In many ways, one of the founders of Bristol. The dark side of that story, however, is that he made that money from the trade of Africans. He was a Premier League slave trader who enriched himself off African flesh. Now, unfortunately, that is the history of Bristol. I mean, Bristol was kind of built off the back of the slave trade. So it's not really that surprising that the history of Colston and the history of Bristol are both tied up so clearly in slavery.
One of our colleagues at The Guardian, a guy called Chris Godfrey, tweeted that one viral video of a slave trader being torn down has probably done more to educate people about Britain's past atrocities than the statue did in 125 years previous. And you can tell that the tweet touched a nerve because it got liked, when I last checked, 135,000 times. That's because it's true, isn't it? We're not taught about these aspects of Britain's past.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I mean, Colston Must Fall has been around for years, and people in Bristol have been campaigning to get rid of Colston for a long time. But in the public consciousness, these things aren't there. We just don't learn about them. And also, I think sometimes we forget the impact on minorities. I mean, like, there's millions of us in this country now with direct links to the history of slavery. And if you talk to people in Bristol, seeing someone like Colston everywhere is a daily act of violence. I mean, that is someone who profited off our ancestors' misery, pain and death. And so, and I think it is interesting that now we've given some, at least some voice to this view of history.
Why is it that you think that we don't focus more on these stories?
We don't focus on the stories because the modern, and this isn't really important, the modern day wealth that we have is built on things like slavery and colonialism. You don't have Bristol, you don't have Liverpool, you don't have London the size it is, or Birmingham or Manchester, without the wealth that was accrued. So to criticise Colston isn't just criticising Colston, it's actually criticising the very nature of what Bristol is. So it's a very difficult conversation to have with the public or in schools, because it does really go to the core of the beliefs that Britain has about itself, that Britain is progressive, that Britain ended slavery, that Britain is this great, wonderful beacon of the world. Actually, no, Britain is where it is today, most primarily because of slavery and colonialism. And that's not a story that we really want to tell our children.
Why don't we want to tell children that story?
Because it calls into question everything. I mean, once you start to really unpick, and it's be interesting to see where these protests go, because, you know, it's really about saying, well, actually, how do we deal with the fact that the world today looks like it does, with white countries being very, very rich, Africa being the poorest, and a kind of racial hierarchy in between? That is because of the way the world was built on the back of slavery, colonialism, etc. You don't have your mobile phones produced, you don't have your clothes produced without the exploitation of black and brown life across the world. And so it raises much bigger questions about how do we actually atone for that? And to atone for that means a massive redistribution of wealth. It means questions about reparations. And these just aren't questions that anybody really wants to address.
One poll that I saw, which really underlines the impact of that, is that a third of British respondents said they saw the empire as a source of pride more than shame, that they thought former British colonies were better off as a result of Britain's presence.
Yeah, which just tells you the lies that we've been taught. And these lies, and I think it's really important to stress that these aren't like bad people telling us lies to indoctrinate us. These are the collective lies that hold together our current social order. Like, if we generally understood that actually the empire wasn't positive, it wasn't good, it was entirely negative in all its features, it was brutal, killed hundreds of millions of people over two centuries, and we really understood the violence that was necessary to have what we have today, then we would have to completely rethink everything.
And you talk about Colston. In many ways, that feels quite black and white, as it does for other individuals across Britain who had a role in the slave trade. A more challenging figure is Winston Churchill, whose role in defeating Hitler doesn't just stop people questioning his record on race. He's actually been voted our greatest ever Britain. Take television presenter Piers Morgan, who has supported protesters over Colston, but really defended Churchill. I watched back a clip of you debating this issue with him a couple of years back.
Indians, because he didn't believe they were really
people. Does it not matter to you one scintilla that Sir Winston Churchill almost single-handedly rallied?
I have to say, it made me feel quite uncomfortable. You were supposed to be arguing with another guest, James Whale, and then suddenly he and the two white presenters, Susanna Reid and Piers Morgan, were all laying into you about it.
For rallying the mood of this country when everyone thought the war was done and
including
dusted and we
all
were
those
defeated.
People, here's by the
a,
way.
Yeah, but that's what they will let black people for on that show, isn't it? I mean, I'm used to it by now. The question was, you know, should we, how are we supposed to, you know, balance Churchill's ledger? Because, I mean, look, Churchill did some positive things for Britain. We can't pretend that those things never happened. But also Churchill was irredeemably racist. Racist for his time. I mean, actually, the Secretary of India, Leo Amery, who was by no means anti-racist, actually said to Churchill that his views of Indians, he could not distinguish them from Hitler's views of the Jews.
That's pretty amazing that was a view of someone in India in that way. I mean, what did Churchill do? Describe what he did that shows that he was racist.
So, I mean, the key thing that we often talk about is the Bengal famine. And this was a time where there's a drought, there's a famine, there's huge hunger in India, but it's in the middle of the Second World War. And Churchill's keen to make sure that the troops are supplied. And so actually diverts food and grain around India, away from India, at a time where it's very clear that India needs its grain. This wasn't to actually feed the troops. This was just to put it in stock, just in case you needed to feed the troops. I mean, it was literally the lives of European soldiers were that much more valuable. And some of Churchill's comments about this, when he was asked about it at the time, well, you know, they breed like rabbits, so it doesn't really matter if a lot of them die off. They'll just replace themselves. I mean, this is actual policy of the government at the time to essentially starve 3 million Indians just so we have backup for British troops.
I've watched and read a fair bit about Churchill, and you always get this hugely positive sheen because, of course, he's the person who defeated Hitler and in doing so defeated the world's biggest fascist. But clearly that story is much more complicated. Actually, the most negative I ever read about Churchill, weirdly, because he didn't mean me to take this away from him, was in Boris Johnson's book about him. And I came away and I thought, oh, he's not a great guy. I actually said that to Boris Johnson once, and he made that point that he didn't expect me to come away with that take on him.
Yeah, but it wasn't just the Indians. I mean, he was hated by the Irish. He was hated by many people. He believed in eugenics. And again, actually, at the time, conservative MPs, at the time, younger ones, were a bit wary of Churchill because he was known to be deeply racist. So when you look back and say, well, he was just a man of his time, people at the time said Churchill was irredeemably racist. This is not just looking back and judging by a different standard. I mean, even the idea that Churchill won the war is complete nonsense. I mean, the war was won largely because Germany went into Russia. Or what about the colonial troops in Africa, Asia, and the Caribbean? One man did not win the war. So actually, the place we give to Churchill is this very white supremacist Little England version of history, which really doesn't bear any resemblance to what actually happened.
Well, let's talk about that, because I'm really interested in this historical denial, because it feels to me like it's more pronounced in Britain than it is in other countries in the world. We've seen the terrible racism, systemic racism that has led to the protests in America. But arguably, in America, people are more willing to be open about their segregationist past. They talk about the slave trade. They don't deny that it happened. Whilst here, there is this slightly different position. What makes Britain different, and why does that matter today?
So the biggest difference is that because slavery happens in America, it means that, you know, 150 years ago, you have millions of African Americans in the country. So they don't have a choice but to talk about issues of racism. And this is because African Americans organize, challenge, you know, protest, etc. Whereas in Britain, we kind of offshored racism and colonialism, right? Slavery happens in the Caribbean. So when emancipation happens, you know, my family doesn't come here till 1960s, right? And so what that means is we can have this idea that somehow slavery is not as important to Britain as it is in America. Somehow what happened in India and colonialism isn't as important because it happened far away. So the biggest problem we have is that we understand British history through the narrow nation state, but really Britain was only ever great when it was an expansive empire. And India and the Caribbean and Africa, parts of Africa, were all part of the British nation. But because we don't really understand that, we see those things as different, foreign and exotic.
And how much is that important today? I just want to talk about some of the responses to the protests here in the UK. Health Secretary Matt Hancock urged people not to attend them because of coronavirus, but he also said Britain isn't a racist country.
Do you think that this country is racist?
I don't, but I do think that there's injustice that needs to be tackled. And I've spent my political life fighting for equality and for diversity. And I think that, you know, I think we're one of the most tolerant and open societies in the world, but there's always more.
And this was all about America and not here.
I think, thankfully, this is all based in response to events in America rather than here.
On Sunday evening, Boris Johnson tweeted that the Black Lives Matter protests had been subverted by thuggery and were a betrayal to the cause they purport to serve. Were you surprised to hear the government say those things? And to what extent are we hearing those things because we fail to talk about our past?
I mean, it should be no surprise. I mean, the Tory Party have shown, like Maya Angelou said, when someone shows you who they are, you should believe them. And the Tory Party have shown us again and again and again that they have no credibility on issues of racism. And I mean, the use of some of the language that Boris Johnson has used, I mean, the idea of thuggery would be any way reasonable to put the black people protesting just shows you the ignorance at the heart of this government. But we shouldn't be surprised because, I mean, how can you be looking at a report that was coming from the own government that said that victims of COVID-19, more likely to be ethnic minority, more likely to die. This should have been a moment that showed us very clearly that racism is a matter of life and death. Like, in all areas of social life in this country, whether it's health, whether it's unemployment, whether it's prisons, whether it's anything, there is clear structural racism. Obvious. So the idea that this is somehow foreign to us just shows how little understanding of the issue of racism there is. Britain isn't just a racist country. It's one of the countries that really was the architect of the racism that we see across the world today, and particularly actually in America.
Just beyond that, I just want to talk about Boris Johnson's video and article where there was definitely a shift in tone.
The death of George Floyd took place thousands of miles away in another country.
I mean, he first made that same point, which was to stress that what happened to Floyd happened thousands of miles away and in a different jurisdiction. He said Britain had taken great strides. He was boasting about his own cabinet.
Yes, I'm proud to lead the most ethnically diverse government in the history of this country, with two of the four great offices of state held by a man and a woman of Indian origin.
Although it's been pointed out that there isn't a single black figure in the cabinet. But he did talk about the National Front in the 70s and the disproportionate impact of coronavirus. He did essentially talk about racism today. What did you make of it?
Yeah, but it's the kind of thing where you talk about it, but you don't really talk about it. Like, there's talk about it and not understand it. So the protests have meant that the government has to respond and has to put out some kind of response. But if you actually look, scratch a little bit beneath the surface, you can see the horrors behind the words. I mean, the idea we progress because the National Front don't march in the street. Okay, that's nice, right? And it is better that my generation haven't had to deal with the National Front in the same way that my parents' generation had to. But that takes away from looking at the deeply structural issues. I mean, what is the government going to do about its reporting to COVID? What is the government going to do about unemployment? The issues of policing, stop and search, significantly more likely to be stops and search. Black people are actually more overrepresented in the prison population per our number in the general population in England and Wales than in America. And just having a couple of black or brown faces in cabinet makes no difference to this, especially when you're presiding over a government whose immigration policy is basically set to ban the very key workers that would be needed to treat the disproportionate black and minority ethnic victims of COVID. I mean, this government, it can't have it both ways.
So basically what you're saying is this is largely rhetoric, and rhetoric from a prime minister who doesn't have a great track record when it comes to language around race.
A prime minister doesn't have a great track record is a very nice way to put it. I mean, if we have somebody in parliament who's used the word picketing, I mean,
in America, In response to this, we are seeing changes to the very specific things you're talking about, for example, policing. It doesn't feel as if in this country we're about to see momentum around big changes on factors like that. But could the protests in Britain, which seem to have focused themselves in a way on that historical point, change the way that we talk about our history?
Yeah, I think that is one thing the protests certainly, I think it's already done. I mean, the pulling down of Colston's statue, as you said before, it's opened up a different conversation. So I think that is one area where you can see very clearly that, you know, education, the idea that we need to teach a different history. And even as a small thing, if you go on Amazon and try and find any books by Black British authors or about race, they're all gone. Like, there's been something has changed where people are now looking at things and saying, actually, we need to get a different source of information and hopefully also get that into our school system.
Coming up, why Colston and Churchill are just the start of the story. So, Amna, we're now in a situation where the toppling of statues is really gathering momentum. All Labour councils in England and Wales are now examining statues for links to slavery. In London, Sadiq Khan wants all the capital's landmarks, including street names and the names of public buildings and plaques, to be looked at. We've already had a statue of Robert Milligan, a slave trader, removed from the Docklands in London. We've seen protests that you were at in Oxford looking at statues of Cecil Rhodes. There are also questions about the former Home Secretary, Henry Dundas, who delayed the abolition of slavery and who is commemorated in Edinburgh. We actually did an episode on this podcast on the Bristol bus boycott. And what amazed me was that most of us had never been taught about that or about any of these individuals that are now being looked at again. I find that really shocking. Do you feel the same way when you look at your education?
Oh, definitely. I was a massive history nerd in school. I was taught about the civil rights movement in the US, and we were taught about Martin Luther King and the Birmingham bus boycott. And you can imagine my shock and surprise when it took me until I was in my 20s to learn that we also had a bus boycott and a civil rights movement here in Bristol. I just laugh when I think about what I actually learned in GCSE and A-level. It totally unprepared me for being a citizen in this country. And that's why this is a problem. It isn't just about, oh, placating the left. It's people are growing up not knowing what other people went through, not knowing what other communities have gone through. And I just don't understand how you're meant to have some sort of cohesive society when there's just these large blind spots. Like, and I think with the protesters, what they were saying was, why do I know all of King Henry's wives, you know, and I don't know this thing that's happened just a few miles away from me? And though there's a lot of focus on the statues, their actually much bigger aim is to what people call decolonize education.
What's next for the protests?
That's the question everyone is asking. It's very hard to predict because people are also very wary of coronavirus, but for others, they're really revitalized. They see this as a moment. You know, someone said to me, like, what we have now is millions of people across the world are going out onto the street to fight against the oppression that Black people and ethnic minorities face. She hasn't really ever remembered that happening in her lifetime. And she said, you know, we just need to jump on it and we need to keep this going. It does feel like there's this big momentum for this summer that we're going to see what could be a really positive movement calling for change. You know, I was looking into where are we seeing other protests this week alone. And just on Monday, I found 25 cities or towns are having Black Lives Matter protests. And it ranges from, you know, quite big areas, as well as, you know, areas much, much more distant, places you wouldn't think would be coming out in their big numbers for Black Lives Matter, you know, like Ledbury, Ludlow, Tamworth Castle. There might be only gathering about 100, 200 people, but the passion is still really, really there. So, yeah, I think we might be going towards a big summer of protest. You know, a Notting Hill Carnival has been cancelled this year, but at the protest, someone said, we're going to plan to have a protest in every major UK city instead. We're going to protest for freedom.
That was Amna Modin and Kayindi Andrews. Do read Kayindi's piece at theguardian.com on 20 positive ways to help make society less racist. And as for Amna, she is such a star reporter for The Guardian and has done brilliant stuff this year. Do check out her reporting on the website and her previous Today in Focus episodes linked to that. One was on why one London neighbourhood had suffered so many COVID deaths. And from earlier this summer, her remarkable reporting project, Young British and Black, about the young activists who organised Britain's biggest race equality rallies for centuries. You heard in this episode how both Amna and I were never taught at school about a really important moment in British history, the Bristol bus boycott. Tune in tomorrow to hear back our Today in Focus episode all about it. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Mithali Rao. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.